This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Lovely Bones, the new Peter Jackson movie based on the novel by Alice Siebold, comes out today. Our film critic, David Edelstein, will review the movie later in the show. But we'd like to start out by replaying Terry's 2002 interview with the author herself. When Alice Siebold's The Lovely Bones was published 7 years ago, Time magazine called it the breakout fiction debut of the year. The story is about the rape, murder, and mutilation of a 14-year-old girl. Our own book critic, Maureen Corrigan, said the subject matter made her reluctant to pick up the book, but reading it gave her a singular, disturbing, and even enlightening literary experience. Alice Siebold was herself the victim of a violent sexual assault. She was raped during her first year in college. Her 1999 memoir about that experience is called Lucky. Siebold's novel, The Lovely Bones, begins with the attack on the girl. The rest of the novel is narrated from heaven, where the girl observes her family and friends as they try to carry on after her death. We'll start with a reading from the beginning of the book. The girl has taken a shortcut home from junior high through a cornfield. She meets a neighbor, Mr. Harvey, who forces her to take off her clothes. Before we start, I should let you know that what you're about to hear is graphic and disturbing. It may be upsetting to some listeners and may not be appropriate for children to hear.
"Don't, Mr. Harvey," I managed, and I kept saying that one word a lot, "don't," and I said "please" a lot, too. Franny told me that almost everyone begged "please" before dying. "I want you, Susie," he said. "Please," I said. "Don't," I said. Sometimes I combined them, "please don't," or "don't please." It was like insisting that a key works when it doesn't, or yelling, "I've got it, I've got it, I've got it," as a softball goes sailing over you into the stands. "Please don't." But he grew tired of hearing me plead. He reached into the pocket of my parka and balled up the hat my mother had made me, smashing it into my mouth. The only sound I made after that was the weak tinkling of bells. As he kissed his wet lips down my face and neck and then began to shove his hands up under my shirt, I wept. I began to leave my body. I began to inhabit the air and the silence. I wept and struggled so I would not feel. He ripped open my pants, not having found the invisible zipper my mother had artfully sewn into their side. "Big white panties," he said. I felt huge and bloated. I felt like a sea in which he stood and pissed and I felt the corners of my body were turning in on themselves and out, like in Cat's Cradle, which I played with Lindsay just to make her happy. He started working himself over me. "Susie, Susie," I heard my mother calling. "Dinner is ready." He was inside me. He was grunting. "We're having string beans and lamb." I was the mortar. He was the pestle. "Your brother has a new finger painting, and I made apple crumb cake."
That's Alice Siebold reading from the opening of her new novel, The Lovely Bones. I'm sure a lot of listeners are wondering why write about something so horrible, so unthinkable, the rape and dismemberment of a 14-year-old girl.
Because it's part of life. You know, that's the simplest answer, I think, for me. It's very much part of the experience of what it is to live in this culture. It happens all the time.
Now, you were raped yourself when you were a freshman in college, and that's a subject of an earlier book you wrote, a memoir. And reading those two books back to back, I was really struck by the difference in the descriptions of the rape. The rape, as you describe it in your memoir, is very brutal, very detailed in its brutality. It's as if you're reliving every moment and describing it like a journalist.
Mm-hmm. I think they are very different books in my mind, even though they both not only have violence but start out in violence. One of them is factual, and I tell every detail in some way in the memoir, and the other one is a fictive voice, and there's so much more being given in the first chapter of The Lovely Bones in terms of getting to know her character and some of the facts of her family and her background.
I got the impression that the kind of moment-by-moment description of the brutality that's in your memoir is something you felt didn't belong in this new novel, in the description of the brutality that this 14-year-old faces.
Yeah, funny thing is that I did write the beginning of The Lovely Bones before I wrote my memoir. So Susie's, the violent crime that occurs in Susie's life happened in terms of writing about it before a description of my own rape was written by me later. I think in order to separate the two stories to make sure that Susie was not doing any of my work for me when I returned to the novel, I stopped to write Lucky. And one of the things that it was very important for me to do was to get all the facts down of my own case. So they had been written, they existed whole in a whole nother book, and I could go back to Susie and she could lead me where she wanted to take me and tell me her story in the way she wanted to tell it, as opposed to me feeling perhaps that I needed to really tell the real deal about every detail about rape and violence. I did that in the memoir as opposed to the novel. Because I wanted my characters to rule the novel, not some sort of desire to talk about rape and reveal rape to readers.
Your memoir ends, "I live in a world where the two truths coexist, where both hell and hope live in the palm of my hand." Is that in a way where your novel picks up with hell and hope or hell and heaven being side by side?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of my major motivations in terms of how I live my life. And also, though, why I see fiction as so incredibly important is to be able to give, in a very short space, the context for those two things coexisting and coexisting in an honest way, where hope is really springing out of something that was is hard won, as opposed to purchased in the, you know, how to cope section at the local bookstore.
After Susie is raped and killed and mutilated, and this is in the first chapter, she goes to heaven, and the rest of the story is narrated by her as she experiences this part of heaven and looks down on her family and neighbors as they go on without her. What interested you in this idea of your narrator being in heaven looking down on the people she's had to leave behind?
I think I needed to find a way, and first I have to say that, again, when Susie's voice presented it to me, she presented completely, and she was already in heaven. So that was something when I got to the end of the first 15 pages, which I did not know was going to be the first chapter of a novel. I had my character, I had where she was, and I had what had happened to her. And because she was such a bossy main character, I had no choice. I had to follow her. So, though it was not conscious, a choice to place her in heaven, once I realized that she had put me there in some way, it is a position from which she can tell a story to a reader and bring a reader to places that they wouldn't have access on and that she wouldn't have access on unless she were in heaven. And to see, referring back to the previous question about heaven and hope or hope and hell, all those things, to see those things put together in a context that is ultimately in some way horrible but doesn't have to be so threatening that readers are afraid to read about the truth or about the reality that a girl like Susie would experience.
In your memoir about being raped, you write, "The burden of being father and mother to a rape victim fell very heavily on my parents." And I'm wondering if that thought informs some of the writing of your novel, because part of the novel is about the after effects of the rape and murder on Susie's family.
Definitely. The experience of violence, particularly a tabooed violence, like a rape in my case, and particularly like a rape and dismemberment in the case of Susie's family in the novel, is one of the most alienating experiences that I think you can have. And for my parents, it proved to be very strange sometimes, even among their close friends, even with people who didn't intentionally mean to say things that were hurtful, for instance, and sometimes hurtful through ignorance, which is not necessarily their fault. And I think definitely that that transferred to the idea of Susie's family being extremely alienated in their circumstances.
You write about the burden of guilt on the parents in the novel. Susie says about her father, every day he got up, before sleep wore off, he was who he used to be. Then as his consciousness woke, it was as if poison seeped in. At first he couldn't even get up. He lay there under a heavy weight, the guilt on him, the hand of God pressing down on him, saying, you were not there when your daughter needed you. Do you want to talk a little bit about the guilt you imagine the parents feeling?
It's an interesting thing. Some of the father was another character for me in the novel that was there very quickly, very immediately, and he really, to me, is the heart of the family. I think particularly with a sexual assault crime, whether the victim, if the victim is a child, whether it's a male or a female child, fathers often feel extremely responsible for what happens in that way to their children. They want to be able to fix it very, very much and go out and do something. And it has become somewhat stereotypical in movies and television that the father wants to go and catch or kill the perpetrator. But the truth is that it's a stereotype that reflects reality. In my own experience, I can count the number of times that, both my father but also boyfriends, male friends, particularly would say things like, you know, I want to kill the bastard. Just in this desire to do something, and also to great shame because the perpetrator is male.
After you were raped, when you were trying to figure out what you were doing with your life and dealing with all the wounds that this rape left you with, psychological and physical, were you at the same time watching your parents dealing with a different set of wounds caused by the same rape?
Definitely, particularly my mother, I think. You know, it just hits the entire family like a ton of bricks. And trauma is, especially when it's a trauma that is not a well-known trauma for those traumas that are well-known, really, there's so much to try to understand. I remember watching television, say, with my sister after the rape when I was just basically lying on the couch and trying to recover. And if anything came on that made her maybe think about violence or whatever, she would stare back at me, and it made me highly self-conscious. But she was deeply trying to understand what my experience had been. And I think one of my motivations for writing my own book, and certainly also a motivation for writing the novel, is the desire to just put it out there on the table. This is what a rape can look like. And if people maybe know more about it, then the victim's not as alienated, nor is the victim's family. And nor are people who live across the street as afraid of saying something really stupid, because maybe they're more educated about what the crime is.
Now, you said earlier that it was only after writing the beginning of your novel, The Lovely Bones, that you decided to go back and write a memoir about your rape. And you said it was because you wanted to, like, tell your own story so that your own story wasn't superimposed on your character's story. I'm interested in how your memory functioned of mm-hmm. the incident, because, you know, when after something that's about as traumatic as it gets happens to you, on the one hand, you really want to forget it so that it's not obsessing you and haunting you all the time. On the other hand, I suppose in a lot of ways you don't want to lose the memories that have been recorded so that you can continue to comprehend the experience. So did you find that you had, like, vivid memories of it, vivid enough to write an almost journalistic account of it? Or did you have to work to regain memories that you had tried to forget?
I would say my memory for the rape itself and the incidents surrounding the rape, like the trial, was better 5 to 7 years after the actual event, even up to 10, than it was in the first 3 or 4 years afterwards. You know, I very directly went into therapy right after the rape, all miserable experiences. And then I didn't do anything like that for about the next 10 years. And I found a lovely therapist who had the, you know, uniqueness of being free in New York and worked with her. But only after, I'd say, a full 10 years away from the rape was I able to face the rape and deal with the clear memories of it. Luckily, one of the things I did right after the rape, because I was a kind of a, you know, morbid poetic kid, was write verbatim accounts of exactly what had happened to me physically and what the light had been like and things like that in a journal of mine.
You were already interested in writing when you were raped. You were a freshman in college. Later in college, you were studying with the poet Tess Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the assignments she gave you after she realized about this trauma in your life was to write a poem that started, "If They Caught You."
Right.
I could see you responding one of two ways to that. One way to go, "Oh, give me a break," and the other to actually write a great poem. tell us what your response was to that.
I think with Tess, who was one of those teachers, I mean, I have taught and I have had wonderful teachers, and I believe that atmosphere, particularly for those students who are going through anything traumatic, can be an incredible atmosphere. And Tess did not shy away from dealing with a student who I'm sure a lot of people just thought, like, eek, keep her away from me. She might explode on me. She forced my hand on that. I had written a vague kind of poem about rape. We had a discussion in her office. She asked me if it were based on anything that had actually happened to me in my life. I told her, and then she suggested that. I admired her greatly as a poet. She was an extremely empathetic teacher. And out of that, I decided, okay, she's forcing me to do something. It feels a little weird, but it was a great thing to do. So, and they caught him a week later. So who knows? There was a little magic in that assignment.
People often wonder if writing is therapeutic. If you're writing about a trauma, does that help the pain of the trauma recede? I mean, Susie in the novel says something about, I forget exactly what she says, but it's something like every time she tells her story, like a drop of the pain goes away.
Right.
But as a writer yourself who's written about your own trauma and then written a mm-hmm. fictionalized version of a similar trauma, is writing therapeutic or do you think that that's really the wrong way to approach it anyways?
My feeling, and it's pretty, you know, rigorous, is that therapy is for therapy, and that writing can be therapeutic, but therapeutic writing should not be published. My job as a writer is to go through the therapy myself, and if I manage to get through it and I feel I have something to share from that, to share it with my audience or my readers, but I don't write novels and seek to have them published so that I can get therapy from having written them. That's really the responsibility of an individual to do outside the context of their published work.
Writers usually have to have some kind of empathy and understanding of each of their characters, the good guys and the bad guys. Do you feel like in your novel you had to have empathy for the rapist, who's a man from the neighborhood? He's a man that the family knows.
Definitely. I mean, in my own personal belief, you can't write a good character unless you have both compassion and respect for them. So Mr. Harvey, who is the killer in the book, yes, I have great compassion for him. There are moments where he attempts to try to do things other than what his driver's instinct is telling him to do, by counting things obsessively or building things. So he resists up until the point where he's no longer able to resist. And, you know, that is, you can have compassion without forgiveness. And I think that's what I would say.
Were you able to find that kind of compassion for the man who raped you?
I would say eventually, certainly not immediately. But, you know, we're all born into this world in very different ways, and we have different experiences of it. And I don't know a lot about him, but some of the things I do know led me to feel compassion for him. There are also many people who had much more worse circumstances than he did that have managed not to go out and rape people. But that doesn't mean you can't have compassion for them. I don't forgive him, but, you know, he's a human being. You have to move on. You know, it's just as simple as that. And so you find a way to move on. And having compassion for people just in general is a good way to live in life.
Well, Alice Siebold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Siebold, author of The Lovely Bones, speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. The great German Wagnerian tenor Max Lawrence isn't as well remembered in this country as several of his colleagues. Maybe because he stayed in Germany during World War II and had a reputation as Hitler's favorite tenor. But a new documentary suggests that his story is more complicated. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
The German tenor Max Lawrence had several strikes against him in Nazi Germany. He was both homosexual and married to a Jewish woman. But he had one thing going for him. He was the greatest German-born tenor of his day. After its bitter defeat in World War I, Germany and the Nazi Party were looking for heroes. Lawrence's heroic singing and size, he was more than 6 feet tall, made him a national symbol. Remaining in Germany during World War II, he not only survived the war unscathed, but he had the power to help those close to him. This is part of his complex story in a new biographical documentary, Wagner's Master Singer, Hitler's Siegfried, The Life and Times of Max Lawrence, directed by Eric Schultz and Klaus Wischmann, which is now out on DVD, along with a thrilling CD of extended excerpts of a live 1938 performance of his most famous role, Wagner's Siegfried. The documentary, mostly in German but with English narration and subtitles, weighs Lawrence's considerable artistic achievement against his poignant biography. Max Sulzenfuss, Lawrence's real name, was the beefy but shy and conflicted son of a butcher. Among the talking heads are a handful of important German performers, including world-renowned baritone Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. All of them show boundless admiration for Lawrence's performances. One compares him to a lion pouncing on the notes. Another says his voice went through you like a red-hot sword. Alongside Lawrence, one tenor says, all the others were wimps. He didn't just produce the notes, Fischer-Dieskau says. He embodied them and sang everything to the hilt, and that you could hear his intensity and expressive power in the clarion timbre of his voice. Here's an exciting clip of Lawrence as Siegfried, with the legendary Wagnerian soprano Frieda Leider as Brunhilde, in a 1934 film made at the Bayreuth Festival, the annual Wagner Festival begun by Wagner himself. Lawrence was the major German tenor at Bayreuth. During the war, the festival's CEO was Winifred Wagner, who was born in England and married Wagner's homosexual son, Siegfried. She was not officially a Nazi, but she seemed to have adored Hitler, who spent a great deal of time at Bayreuth. In an interview, She talks about Lawrence being arrested after being caught in flagrante with one of the Bayreuth vocal coaches. If Lawrence were found guilty and forbidden to sing, she says, she threatened to shut down the theater. But Hitler loved Bayreuth, and Lawrence's trial ended without a guilty verdict. Once, the SS came to Lawrence's house to remove his Jewish wife and her mother. But she had Göring's sister's private phone number, and 10 minutes later, the SS men left the two women unharmed. The following night, the outraged Lawrence canceled a performance in Vienna at which Hitler was the guest of honor. After the war, he became an Austrian citizen. Still, the question remains why Lawrence didn't leave Germany. As one performer says in this film, many German artists were idealists, and things in Germany might have been different if more artists had shown greater interest in politics. After the war, many people assumed Lawrence had been a Nazi. Maybe he'd be better remembered if, like the other great Wagnerian tenor of the period, the Danish-born Lauritz Melchior, surprisingly unmentioned in this documentary, he had shifted his career to England and the United States.
By 1943, it was too late to leave the country. Lawrence was lucky. Only on stage was he stabbed in the back.
Among the most moving moments of the film are the sequences in which the interviewed singers are listening to Lawrence's extraordinary recordings, nodding or mouthing the words along with him, with expressions of pure bliss.
Lloyd Schwartz is the classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed the documentary Wagner's Master Singer, Hitler's Siegfried, The Life and Times of Max Lawrence. Thomas Hoving, the influential and attention-getting director of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art from 1967 to 1977, died yesterday at his home in Manhattan. He was 78 years old. Hoving's 10-year reign was transformational for the museum. His ambition was to blow the dust off the place and make it into a people's cultural paradise. He opened a gift shop and brought in blockbuster shows like King Tut, which attracted crowds in unprecedented numbers. He expanded the museum and bought new works with money he raised by selling old ones. After leaving the museum, he edited Connoisseur magazine and wrote a memoir in which he revealed that when he came to the Met, he saw himself as the new guard. When Terry Gross spoke with Thomas Hoving in 1993, he told her he was intent on getting rid of the old guard, particularly the trustees.
Well, they talked rather like this, you know, and they didn't like the madding herd, and they didn't like primitive art, and they thought that contemporary art would best be perhaps burned.
Like that. Until I got there, you did not have a department of contemporary painting and sculpture.
Why not?
Beats me. And no one was allowed, a living artist was not allowed to show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And the idea that this great encyclopedia, the only one on earth that has 50 centuries of something, of every civilization, did not have living people, you had to die before you got in there, seemed to me so stultifying that we did change it and we began to show one-man shows of living artists, and it was marvelous.
How did you change it?
Simply said, we're going to have a department of contemporary, and if you have contemporary, the chances are somebody's going to be alive. And one of the shows we did was Francis Bacon. And he actually came in and arranged the exhibition himself. And that was stunning to watch what an artist does with his own works. Totally different from what an exhibitor or a curator would have done. Completely different.
One of the first contemporary paintings that you showed at the Met when you were there was James Rosenquist's F-111. Why was it so controversial?
I can't figure it. Look at it today. It's a huge pop art painting, and it's got part of the F-111 jet fighter. It's got a baby doll under a hair dryer, and it's got some spaghetti rolling around on the floor. I mean, it's one of these kinetic images that Jim Rosenquist did then very well, still does. And I had made the mistake of exhibiting it as a history painting. There used to be in the academies of the 18th and 19th century categories of painting, portraiture, still life, history painting. And it was a history painting. It was a modern history painting. So I showed it in the same gallery as Jacques-Louis David's Death of Socrates. And I showed it with a large sketch of Emmanuel Leutze's Washington Crossing the Delaware. And the art critics, one of them accused me of being morally turpitudinous. And I had to go to Webster's, frankly, to find out what turpitudinous meant. It means you have a low, sleazy, and disgusting lifestyle or something. And I was morally incorrect because I showed this picture next to Jacques-Louis David, and they got really annoyed because of that.
Did you
like
the painting?
People got very annoyed. I adored the painting. I still do. I tried to get it for the Met. Robert Scull and his wife Ethel owned it, and they promised me they would give it. They didn't. They promised me they would give the great Andy Warhol Ethel Scull 36 times, and guess what? They walked out. They chintzed.
Now, why do I think that you're speaking of these people differently now than you spoke of them or to them when you were the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art?
Well, when I was facing Nelson Rockefeller, I kissed his feet, I suckled his fingers, I said, sir, I was a toady. Now, occasionally, I would come right to grips with some of these people, although I did, God knows, flatter them and try to make them very happy. I would tell them, you're wrong on this. Or, you know, we're not going to do that. So I did have a couple of times when I would get into fracases with potential donors. Well, they tried to throw me out. The board tried to oust me 3 times for good reason. They should have probably, but they didn't. So it was both. I mean, I toadied sometimes and then would hit them in the face the other.
Were you ever picky about who you took money from? Would you take it from anybody who'd give it?
No, we were quite selective about it, and the tobacco. We had one brush with Philip Morris for a collection, Treasures of the Great High Foundation, which are the American Indian things that were up in 158th Street. It's about to go down to the Smithsonian now. You know, it's going to be a big American Indian Museum on the Mall. It was that collection. It had not been shown. We showed extraordinary pieces from this huge collection. And we got a grant from Philip Morris, and I looked at the proofs of the catalog, and there the chairman of Philip Morris had written and signed, and he had a paragraph starting going, I said, because of our deep affection for the reverence that American Indians held for tobacco. So I called him and said, hold it. You know, what is this? It's a religious experience. You can't do that. So the guy said, you know, we're going to take our money away. I said, take your money away. Well, they didn't, but that paragraph was expunged, and we never dealt with the cigarette guys anymore.
In your book, Making the Mummies Dance, you say that to be effective and to survive as director, you had to be part gunslinger, part ward healer, legal fixer, accomplice, smuggler, anarchist, and toady. I think we got to the toady part that you were referring to.
Right.
Let's get to the part of your job description that you describe as accomplice smuggler.
Well, in the days before 1971 in the art business, there were no rules. There was no UNESCO treaty trying to stop the outrageous flow of smuggled treasures from Turkey, Greece, Italy. You bought an antiquity because it was beautiful. And you didn't have to have papers for provenance, whether it came from this or that collection. Everybody knew it was dug up 3 months before. The mud was virtually still fresh on the stuff. And it cost whatever it cost. You said, great, and buy it. Then it became apparent in 1970, when UNESCO was beginning to draft its treaty that many nations have signed, America has, that the old era of looking the other way or laughing about it was gone. And so I, as director, became part of the drafting team on UNESCO treaty because I knew, hey, it's over. So don't try to keep the past alive. Now you got to be respectful of what did this thing have as a history. And we began to do that rather sharply. And the Mets' dealings with known hot pieces began to diminish sharply after about 1971. And they don't do it at all today. Virtually no museum does. Well, there are few in the United States that still do.
You've said that you've used subterfuge in buying works. And one example you give is when you were buying the Velazquez painting, you organized what you described as a disinformation campaign. You say, we spread rumors around like the disinformation section of the KGB.
And probably we did a better job. There are several copies of the great painting Juan de Pareja. There's one at the Hispanic Society in New York, which is definitely a copy of about 50, 100 years later. We put out rumors that this was the real one, and the one coming up for auction must have been one of the copies. And people believed it, because you're looking at a painting for $5 million, you don't want any doubts.
How'd you spread that rumor?
Oh, we just told various people that I know go to nothing but cocktail parties and dinner parties and tell their host and hostess what they know. And we saw to it that they knew, and the word spread like wildfire. Wildfire.
What is the morality of spreading lies about art?
Well, it's part of the business. It has no morality whatsoever. It just happens to be a technique that, since it wasn't published, it was rumors, it was an opinion. So what? You know, it was part of, it's smoke screening.
One of the things that you are pretty famous for in the art world is being one of the forces behind the blockbuster show. You didn't invent the blockbuster show, but you certainly popularized it. And you were one of the people kind of responsible for its spread. Is that the right? Popularity?
We one focused it. The whole point of blockbusters at the Met was to bring the public something they could never see on their own or have a very hard time seeing. I mean, it's not everybody can get on a plane and go to the Hermitage for a long weekend or go to Cairo for 2 days and come back after seeing King Tut. So we wanted to bring to people things that, one, they could not see. Two, they didn't even know was art. For example, Scythian art. These are the nomad tribes of the Ukraine who populated that part of the what was then the Soviet Union during the 6th and 5th century B.C. And not a single one of their glorious works of art had ever been seen outside the Soviet Union because Peter the Great had passed a law saying it should not be moved or sold or allowed out. So nobody knew about it. And it's art that is equivalent to the greatest Greek and Hellenistic art. And we showed that. We did not do paintings from the Hermitage because we have Rembrandts, we have Poussins, we have all that. And we decided to exchange our old masters for something that nobody even knew about. So part of it was to bring to people through a temporary exhibition things that you could never have in the permanent collection. That was the main reason. We also marketed these shows pretty well. We were the first ones that ever ran ads. We were the first ones that ever had radio and television ads and people talking about it. We were also the first ever to have a corporation fund one of these things. And they then picked up advertising campaigns, and that had a further impact upon the word getting out. So in a sense, we took what existed, great art shows had been for some time, and simply put them into the contemporary mode. And it worked wonders. I think there were some lovely ones and there were some awful ones. I think right now the age of the blockbuster is a dinosaur. I think it's dead, and I think they should be given the last rites.
Why do you think it's dead now?
Well, they're not really blockbusters anymore. They say they are. There'll be a great show of Caravaggio in which there are three Caravaggios and the rest are followers. And you can't afford. The point is that art prices have risen to such ridiculously astronomical heights that nobody can afford the cost of insurance and other things to bring the works of, you name it, into one place anymore. It's virtually impossible to do. And even the Matisse show, that may be the last of these hugely expensive things because people are unwilling to lend anymore. And it's too costly. I mean, that show is, what, $6 to $8 million, something like that. That's amazing. $6 to $8 million, my goodness. So I think probably there are other things that can be done instead of the standard blockbuster. They're getting boring.
Thomas Hoving, one last question. The health of the art world.
Mm.
What's your assessment?
Well, if they can get over the political and religious right attack on all art, not just a couple of performance artists or so on, but all art. If they can get over this period of creeping iconoclasm and do it courageously, I think things will be fine. So I think it's generally healthy, but they got to solve the censorship thing. Our greatest exportable product in America today is our freedom of our arts.
Thomas Hoving, speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. The former director of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art died yesterday at age 78. By the way, Ethel Skull eventually donated Warhol's Ethel Skull 36 times to the Met, shared with the Whitney Museum. Alice Siebold's best-selling 2002 novel, The Lovely Bones, is now a movie directed by Peter Jackson, the Oscar-winning filmmaker of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. The story opens with the rape, murder, and mutilation of a 14-year-old girl. She becomes the story's narrator from heaven. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Sitting through Peter Jackson's film of Alice Siebold's The Lovely Bones is an ordeal. I'm not talking about the subject. The book opens with the rape and murder of a 14-year-old girl, so even a good adaptation would be an ordeal. But Jackson's adolescent, new-age, computer-generated fantasy land is an excruciating fusion of the novel's primal trauma and his own sensibility, which is more at home with juvenile, male-dominated Lord of the Rings epics. There isn't a second that rings true on any level. As in the book, the narrator is Susie Salmon, played by Saoirse Ronan, with her red hair and pale, glowing blue eyes. The actress has a lyrical presence, but the movie uses her and those eyes for a kind of cheap, mystical sentimentality. Susie tells the story of her murder, rape isn't mentioned in the film, by a serial killer who happens to live in her neighborhood. The neighbor, Mr. Harvey, is played by Stanley Tucci with a finicky comb-over and caterpillar mustache. He shifts uncomfortably when he's questioned by an oddly oblivious detective, played by The Sopranos' Michael Imperioli, who looks in amazement on Harvey's intricate homemade dollhouses.
You married?
I was.
Yeah. But you have kids?
No, I wish. I wish. But
you mind if I take a look?
No. I make everything myself.
Really?
Oh, yeah. All this. I turn all the banisters myself and make all the shingles and the furniture and...
I used to do cabinet making, but there's not much call for that these days.
Maybe I spend too much time on these things, but...
It's a perfectionist in me, I guess. All it shows.
Thank you.
That's amazing craftsmanship.
Oh, well. I took a risk and tried something new and discovered a talent that I didn't know I had.
What's that underneath the stairs?
Oh, that would be the basement.
Sorry, this guy's so transparent, he might as well have child molester tattooed on his forehead. At first, Susie watches as her parents, played by Mark Wahlberg and Rachel Weisz, react to her disappearance and the discovery of large amounts of her blood, no body, in a pit in a field. She moves back and forth between worlds, in a melancholy state reinforced by Brian Eno's floating score, much of it borrowed from his music for Airports. She stands semi-transparent, watching the living, including the hunk she had a crush on, her younger sister, and even her killer. Then she and a fellow dead girl romp around a verdant CGI never-never land with bits of New Zealand landscape, at times having so much fun, it seems like murder is just about the best present a teen girl could get. It's no mystery where Siebold's premise came from. She revealed in her subsequent memoir with the ironic title Lucky that she was raped in college in a tunnel. The police said she was lucky because the last woman raped there was killed. The Lovely Bones can be taken as a fantasy of the death she didn't have. And the limbo Susie occupies is like a metaphor for Siebold's post-rape detachment from her own body and her haunted inner world. The fantasy landscape might even evoke the otherworldly lightness induced by Siebold's turn to heroin. I think Lucky is the greater book. To work on screen, and I'm not sure it could, The Lovely Bones would need to have been made by someone who could blur the line between literal and metaphorical. Not, in other words, a director whose demarcations between life and limbo are like an illustrated storybook for six-year-olds. Toward the end, Susie drops out of the film, and Jackson seems to think he's making a Hitchcock thriller. Then, in the climax, he cross-cuts between the dead girl's struggle to manifest herself physically and her killer's attempt to dispose of her body. Given Jackson's technique, the outcome of the sequence is bewildering. But then, there are incongruous notes all over the place, especially the presence of Susan Sarandon as an eccentric grandmother out of Auntie Mame. Is The Lovely Bones powerful? Yes. How could it not be, given the grisly, tragic premise? But with that power comes a responsibility to bring to life the tortured emotions that drive Siebold's vision. I don't think Jackson's tawdry sentimentality is badly intentioned. It's just that his cluelessness makes the atrociousness of his movie positively supernatural.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.